So welcome to Fated Mates, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back.
This is episode 4, book 4 of the series, Dark Needs at Night's Edge, which is a very controversial one we discovered.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Lots of people don't really like this one.
But they're wrong.
They are wrong, of course.
I remember reading this the first time around. I remember really liking it the first time around. And then suddenly, like now, this hero is just my pure id. So when I came back to it this time, I was like, oh yeah, Cressley, this is my jam. So anyway, this is the story. Well, we discover ghosts exists in this book.
Well, and to be fair, so does Conrad, right? I mean, she's still, ghosts are a human phenomenon, he explains to her. And so one of the things I really liked about this is we really get a human problem mixed up with a lore problem in this one. And I think there's a lot of really cool things that happen in this one because of it.
Yeah, because honestly, no lore person has ever really had cause to hang out with a ghost or be interact with a ghost.
Right. Why would they? I mean, and that's the thing. Like, we assume ghosts are like otherworldly, but to people in the lore, ghosts are just...
They're human problems.
Yeah, it's a human... Exactly. It's a human problem.
But what's really interesting about this as a concept, you know, as somebody who I've said before, I don't read a huge amount of paranormal. Like, I feel like I've read the big series because I've read the big series. And I haven't really spent a lot of time in the weeds of paranormal, but my instinct is to say that oftentimes when we're building characters and building conflict in romance in paranormal, often the human character, the human heroine or the human hero, mostly heroine, is sort of a go-to conflict, right? Because immortal plus human equals conflict. In general.
Right.
But we don't see humans at all, really, until we see Naomi in the past in her human form before she dies.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, the only other humans were in the previous book, and they were basically like cannon fodder for Bowen freaking out in the, you know.
Oh, right. The gorillas in the jungle.
Yeah. I mean, so they're not like real characters, right? She's our first real character. He's a human. So maybe we should give like a little plot overview. Do you want to do it?
Sure.
You should do it. I got a little lost the one time I tried it.
I'm happy to. I'm happy to be the person who talks about these bananas books. So we begin in the past. We begin in the 20s with a woman who we have not met before, who is a dancer. We know she's a dancer. We know she's a performer. We know she is French. Her name is Naomi. And she is in a big house in New Orleans, outside of New Orleans. And she loves her house, and there's a party happening. And what we know is that she is afraid of her ex-fiancé, who she broke it off with, because he's truly awful and abusive. And there's a big party downstairs, and she is dressed to the nines, and she enters the party. And of course, as is wont to do with women and men, this ex-fiancé turns up and stabs her and kills her dead.
You know what I was thinking, actually, as I read this, and this is just like the prologue, right? That now, sadly, with the many shootings that we get by men in America, and almost within days or hours, we discover that this man had like a history of domestic violence every time. It strikes me this is something that like we've known in fiction for a long time. And somehow, like, seeing this play out in reality, I don't know, like, it just really struck me as a moment. Like, of course this is someone that was going to come and kill her. And he didn't have a gun, right? It's 1920s. But this sort of connection between his sort of jealous, possessive rage in his the way he treats her, and then the fact that he ends up killing her. So I don't know. There was a moment here where this, from the very beginning, just felt very like a viscerally real in a 2018 way, just like it did back in a, you know, 1920s way.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of things. I 100% agree. This book felt the most. I feel like we've said this, we've talked about this every episode, but this felt the most 2018 of all the books to me so far. And also, I had the same sort of similar reaction that, well, of course, this ex-fiancé is going to come and kill her and ruin her life because he believes her life is his to ruin, right?
Right.
But I kept thinking back to this question that we've brought up over and over about what Cressley's doing with the genre as she's writing. And one of the things that we've talked about so much recently, and so much is in sort of the ether of romance right now, is this question of how we talk about the books that began the genre, the Flame in the Flower, the Shanna, the, you know, early days of the genre, and the fact that rape happens in those books, and often it happens at the hands of the hero in the early pages of those books. And, you know, I've written about this and I've talked about this a lot, about what rape means on the page. But one of the things that so many of us who think about the genre as a whole hog, sort of as a, in the scope of romance, talk about is that rape is on the page in these books because rape happens to women, as we know, and because there's no other place in media where women can have this conversation about assault happening and how we experience it and where we go from there. And it's really fascinating to me. I kept coming back to that question of sort of Cressley's beginning with the assault at the hands of a man, the same in that sort of old school way. And then right. The whole thing sort of blows up and starts over.
And yet, and again, this, we're not going to talk about this yet. We'll talk about it in later episodes. Almost all of the characters who suffered prolonged sexual abuse in this series are men.
Right. Cressley writes a hero at the hands of sexual abuse very well and very thoughtfully.
So like you, this is something I'm really, really interested in, this question of, and I think this is something the book is, I think it's also my theory about why this is like a hard one to read, right? Because she's a victim, and we don't read romance to feel victimized.
Right. But like Emma in A Hunger Like No Other, she's not a victim for long. She becomes a very keen survivor. So let me just
wrap up the,
we need to talk about the hero and then we can get deep.
We do. I actually love this hero.
I love this hero so much. This is, so we're going to talk over the course of this about, you know, id in romance. And this is an id hero for me. Sebastian is a living vampire who was turned by his brother. Nikolai
is the one who turns.
He turned all the other brothers.
Right. But okay. Murdoch, it seems, kind of agreed more readily to it. And Sebastian and Conrad are the ones who were furious.
Conrad is a Roth brother. And you'll remember the Roth brothers from the second book in the series, No Rest for the Wicked, where Sebastian and Conrad and Murdoch, the three younger Roth brothers, are all turned into vampires by Nikolai. They're all about to die. They're in a war in the Ukraine or
Estonia.
In Estonia somewhere. And they're in a war and they're all about to die. And their eldest brother is turned into a vampire and then given the opportunity to turn his brothers into vampires. And he does. One of them agrees pretty readily and the other two resist it. And Conrad resists the most. And what we know from the old books is that Conrad has disappeared and they can't find him. And he is here. They find him in chapter one of this book. And he is, has essentially, he has taken blood from the vein. He is a mercenary, a vampire mercenary, which turns out he vowed to become in when he was 13 and human. He joined a cult of sorts of people who were basically destined to kill vampires. They take a vow to kill all vampires. So Conrad has spent the last X number of hundreds of years killing vampires from the vein and demons and other things. He's a mercenary. And so, but taking from blood from the vein makes you crazy. You'd get you if you kill someone that way, you inherit all of their memories and you go mad. You can't stop them from coming when they come. It's sort of this, it's really this like delicious. What Cressley has done is she creates this intensely broken hero, and he's deeply broken by virtue of owning all the memories and actions of every evil person he's ever killed.
Right, exactly. And I think one of the things that's, there's a couple of really fascinating things about like when they capture him. And one of them is he cannot believe that his brothers are trying to take him alive. Like, he's pretty sure that what they're doing is that they're there to kill him because he's a mercenary. He's killed so many vampires. They're out to kill him. And so one of the things that's that, like, from the very beginning, that this relationship with his brothers is so broken that he just thinks, I can't believe they're trying to take me alive. Like, he thought, okay, this is finally it. We're going to fight to the death. And I just think that's fascinating.
He wants the death. Like, I mean, this is a... He hates himself. He hates himself by virtue of being a vampire. I think there's certainly a no small amount of him that hates himself for the job that he has done all these years. And I think he welcomes death. And but he doesn't get it because his brothers love him and their goal is to bring him back into the family fold, which we saw happen over the course of Bowen's book, Wicked Deeds on a Winter's Night, because the Roth brothers were also... No, was it Bowen's book? It's the Roth brothers were also trying to get the magic key that would take them back in time.
Right.
So to fix this exact problem, to bring back their sisters and solve their family woe, which we all know is never going to happen because they're a Russian family and, you know, Tolstoy.
But, okay. Now let's quote Anna Karenina, please.
Because Tolstoy.
All unhappy families. No, that's... Who wrote Anna Karenina? Is that Tolstoy?
Tolstoy.
No. Yeah, all unhappy families are
unhappy. Are unhappy in their own way. So, that all said, they do take him alive, and it takes three strapping vampire brothers to do it, and it's pretty glorious. I can imagine Kate Claiborne, like, just digging deep on that page, like, really excited about it.
Yes.
And then they bring him to an abandoned house that happens to be on the outskirts of New Orleans. It's a great big mansion. Nobody's lived in it for 80 years. Or rather, people have lived in it, but then they've been, I don't know, haunted out of it. It's sort of a plot suggested. It's a pretty dingy, like, broken down house, has lots of the original fixtures. Like, as somebody who lives in New York City, like, crown molding seems to... There's a lot of crown molding, original hardwood. Sounds pretty great to me.
I know. I'm like, I wanted to live in this house.
A+ would risk haunting for this house. And they chain him to a radiator in the house, an old steam radiator. And they leave him there to dry out because he's basically an addict, right? I mean, there's this sort of play on that addiction, like blood from the vein. He feels very addict. It feels very addicty to me.
Well, and it's like both that and insanity, right? And so there's been hints earlier, because we've met other vampires, that if you know, even a drop of someone else's blood means that you could harvest their memories. But Connor has been drinking the blood of hundreds of thousands of people, and the sheer, like, massive quantity of memories, and many of them from people that were themselves killers or rapists or, you know, terrible people, means that he's essentially insane. And I think one of the things... Can we talk about verb tense?
I do want to talk about that. I just want to say one other thing about the addict-y piece, the sort of blood piece. He says at one point, you can't fix me. I'm unfixable, to his brothers. And one of them says, I could fix you. I could drain you. And then I could drain you until you are empty and then essentially like fill you up with bagged blood. And there's no, I don't think that there, obviously that's not how he gets saved. But I think there's an argument to be made that like, we're also seeing the Roth brothers really struggle with their humanity because the instinct there is to say, you know, I don't want to, I, that's the easy way. Like we could just do that. You're immortal. You'll be fine.
Interesting.
But I think it's Sebastian who says it. And then, but Sebastian's sort of like, I can't do that to you. Like, I won't take that from you. I've already, like, we've already done enough to you.
Right. And there's a real sense that even though it's been hundreds of years that, and Conrad can't see this, Naomi can, right? That they're on a mission to get his forgiveness, right? That they see this act of helping him or of like fixing him to be one of restitution, right? We brought you this low, but we can also be the ones to bring you back up.
Yeah. And I think also now that we're talking about it, now that we're in it, humanity, it makes sense that we meet our first human in this book because, well, I guess technically we have met humans before because we've met the Roth brothers. And the truth is that they all struggle with their humanity. And that's their whole story. So maybe it makes sense that Naomi and Conrad are the match that they are.
Right. Like the earlier Roth brothers have Valkyrie mates, right? Because they're, well, part of this is like a session driven, right? Like we're going to see this new, these two groups that were enemies become, you know, but Conrad's not going to be blooded by a Valkyrie, right? He needs something different.
Yeah.
And
there's this real sense that it's that sort of perfect partnership that happens here because Naomi is deeply lonely. I mean, broken and lonely. She is, we meet her in real time, standing at the edge of the property because she's a ghost, she's bound to the house and its property. And there's a newspaper that's been delivered and it's been delivered, you know, 3 feet or 4 feet outside of the property line. And she wants that newspaper so desperately because she just wants some touchstone to the world. And he is so lonely too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I think the thing about both of them, but about Naomi especially, is like we've talked about how many of these early heroines are really, really almost more like archetypes, right? Like Catherine's all about like emotion and Mariquetta's all about power. And, you know, there's this thing we joke about, like, I just want to be seen. Naomi literally has not been seen for 80 years. And that, like, that desperation to not be invisible anymore as a woman, I mean, I just found it. I understand why people don't love her, I guess, theoretically, but I found her to be, you know, almost painfully and beautifully sort of relatable.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't get it. I don't even intellectually get it because I think she's so real. Like, I feel like Cressley sets it up where she's been alone for so long and not just alone. So on top of all of it, she once a month has to relive her death.
Yes.
Right? So it's not just now I'm alone and I have to deal, like, I have to come to terms with being alone, and, like, sometimes I get the paper and sometimes I don't, and, like, this is just my life now, my existence now. She has to relive the moment of that began this loneliness every month at the sliver moon, which I know you want to talk about, which we'll hold off on talking about.
It's like, I do, Sarah. You know what, though? Okay, but even more than the moon thing, though, I would like to talk about, it's almost like this ghostly menstrual cycle, right? I mean, about what is a woman going through once a month? It's like this reminder that you could give birth, you could be alive.
And to the cycle of the moon, yeah.
And for her,
you, English teacher.
I can't help myself. But for her, it's this, you're dead and you're going to relive your death. There's no... life in you, and that's what you're gonna go through every month. And I found that again to be like really poignant in a way that, you know, I just found as like, I don't know, as a woman, right? Like I just found her, like all that being taken away from her to be so kind of profoundly, I don't know. I keep being like, oh, because I like lack the words to describe like just how moved I really was by her loneliness, but also this, I mean, just desolation that she really lives in, right?
And I think the other thing that I want to bring up here, and I think this is a good place to do it, is that this is the first of the books where we see children as a dream, where we see, and I mean, I hadn't thought about this moon cycle thing, and I, yeah, wow, because I feel like this is the first of the books where we start to talk, where we hear, like, I always dreamed of being a mother, right? Mm-hmm. Cressley, until now, we haven't seen that. We haven't seen that sort of desire for progeny. And then there is a moment eventually where Conrad says, like, well, you would want them with me. Like, I'm so broken. I'm such a monster. And she's like, no, of course I would want them with you, you idiot. And like, but this idea of, and I marked it because I had this moment where I was thinking, like, maybe immortals don't necessarily want kids so readily, because again, it goes back to this sense of like they understand the weight of immortality.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating. So in some ways, it doesn't surprise me that the two characters who like most openly consider it are those who are the most alone, who are most cut off from the rest of the world. Like to them, to like, it's really about forming a family, right? And it's not like they have, I mean, you know, he has his brothers, but like forming a family just means something different to these two characters than I think it does to other characters in the lore who are so familiar with like their place in this much larger structure. These two are alone in every way.
And it's really remarkable how it's put together. And I think that Cressley does this. It's almost insidious how she does this, with the way the craft of this book is so perfect. It's so fucking good. Like she's so good, you guys. She's so, I mean, we started this podcast because we love these books and we said like, they're so fun. It's such a bonkers, like bananas read. And it's exactly what we need in 2018, 2019. Like the world is on fire, but like you guys, this is a master class in how to write a book.
Yeah, it really is. Well, and so here's the thing I will say. I have strong feelings about books.
Extreme feelings about tense.
I do have extreme feelings about tense in books. And actually, I have extreme feelings about other things in books. But in romance, I have really extreme feelings about tense because I feel that verb tenses mean something. I mean, I don't know, crazy idea. Now, there are going to be people who disagree with me, and I get that, right? Like,
yeah, we're going to get, this is the episode we're going to get hate mail about.
Yeah, and that's fine. Like, I, you know what? I also feel really comfortable with my opinions, and I'm not trying to convince anyone because really what I'm trying to do, anytime I have really strong feelings, I'm always trying to figure out, like, what are they rooted in, right? I don't really think of myself as, like, a knee-jerk, I hate this thing, right? But I do think that, you know, fiction has existed for a really long time, and the rules that govern how we tell stories have existed for a really long time. So if you're going to break those rules, I'm kind of curious about why. Now, I have really strong negative feelings about first person present tense. I just find it, I personally find it really exhausting to read. Like, I just get really, and I think part of it is I just find I'm like I just want out of that person's brain. But I'm also, it really, it makes me think, like, is this the way people really think about the world in their day? I mean, fiction's always a construct, but I don't walk around narrating to myself what I'm doing. I just don't. So I find it really hard to read characters who are doing that because the veil of, like getting swept away in their story. It's like a constant reminder. Like it just, I can't do it. Whatever. Like I could go on and on about this forever. Kate Claiborne right now is like, I hate you. Cause she is like my polar opposite. She loves it.
And she does it really well. Kate's going to join us for an episode in the future.
So what's interesting, though, about this book is there's no first person, but when we get Conrad's narration at the beginning, it's all in present tense. And when we get Naomi's point of view, it's all in past tense. And to me, I'm totally down with this because it makes narrative sense, right? Like, she is literally stuck in the past. There is no, like, present for her. And he, because he's just, like, riding the waves of people's memories that he's captured, he has no sense of anything but, like, he has no past. It's just, like, what he's experiencing right now. And he even questions that. And so I found myself really fascinated by, like, this really purposeful way that Cressley is using, like, verb tense to communicate something about worldview. Who are these characters right now? And how are they thinking about themselves? And what does that mean about how they're, like, missing each other, right? Because the first time he really sort of, like, sees her, she, like, jolts him back into, like, what I'm going to call, like, a regular narration, right? And it's actually in the book, right? He's, like, feels. He's, like...
Yeah, it's page 86 of the book. I feel like it's important that we cite this moment. It's page 86 of the book, and he is chained in the shower.
Right.
And it's the first moment that they really acknowledge that each other...
exists.
That they can see each other.
Yeah.
And she comes to him and she sees him and she's like, you can see me. She is so floored by the idea that, like, the inkling that she's had that he can see her has finally come to fruition, and he can actually see her. And they talk about what they have this verbal sex, essentially, where they talk about what he would do, what they would do to each other, what he would do to her if he could touch her, because he can't. She's air, right?
Right.
And he essentially cages her against the wall, the sort of vision of her. He cages her against the wall, and he tries to touch her, and he can feel the energy of her, but he can't feel her. And then he says, I'll read it to you. He says, as if a breeze had swept a path through the fog of memories and confusion, he feels clearer as he beholds her face. He feels centered, felt. He felt clearer. Conrad felt centered. And for the rest of the book, it's past.
And this to me is like... why I have to say, like, break all the rules you want, but at some point as a reader, I want to know why you're breaking those rules. And if you're just breaking them to break them, then then you can do that, right? Like,
you're not the boss of me, Jen.
No, of course, right? Authors can do whatever they want, but I find it pretty tedious, like, personally, right? And I tend not to read a lot of it. And that's okay. Like, that's, again, as a reader. And I know plenty of people who are like, I don't even notice that. And that's fine too, right? Like, everyone has their own thing. But it was really interesting because I'm going to now bring up a non-romance. I saw an author I really like of literary fiction, and he writes essays. His name's Kiese Lehmann, and he wrote a book called Heavy. It's a memoir about essentially about being Black in America and his struggle with weight. But it's not just like his physical weight; it's like the weight of all his memories. And at the beginning of the book, in the prologue, he's like interviewing his grandmother and his mother. And there's this part where he talks about why he asks his grandmother why she told so many of her stories in present tense. And she says to him, and it's this amazing, this book is amazing, right? Not a romance. And she says, this land, Key, we work too hard on this land to run. Some of us, we believe the land will one day be free. I've been eating off this land my whole life. Greens, tomatoes, cucumbers, collards, you hear me? That's all I can tell you. As far as these stories, I just try to gather up all the gumption I can before I take it to the Lord. And when I tell it to my children, sometimes I just be trying to put y'all where I've been.
Oh, wow.
And it's amazing. That's incredible. I thought, and this is the thing. I'm like, here's a reason, right? Like, there's this reason that I find really compelling to like play with language, right? And to me, it's most meaningful. And it, again, please do what you want and what feels right to you. But when it is most meaningful to me as a reader is when it's telling me something about your characters. And this is why I think it's so brilliant in this book, right? Like, Conrad goes from having only the minute he's in to having like a sense of who he is, like a centered self when he's with her, even though at that moment she doesn't even really exist for him. The idea of her is enough to like bring him his own self into the world. And I think it's really powerful.
Sure. And it makes perfect sense why it's there too. It's the sense of like, you know, we talk about there are moments in our lives where we can mark, they're time posts, right? And they,
oh, yeah,
we mark before and after. And for Conrad, it's forever before and after Naomi. Prior to that, it was before and after he was turned.
Right.
And now he has something else. And what he has instantly is something to live for, right? Which is a deeply, like, okay, I get it. It's problematic in real life. Like, don't ever marry this guy. But right. In fiction, in romance especially, this idea of a hero who was nothing and now, or felt that he was nothing and now feels that he is everything and must be everything for her is real great.
Yeah.
I am here for it.
Right. Absolutely. Well, and I think it also is a larger hint about how immortals face their immortal lives, right? Like, I mean, we've talked about this a lot, like the weight of time. I mean, so like that whole like package of time that was like Conrad and Misery has now over.
Yeah.
And it's because of this moment with her that so profoundly changed him.
Yeah. And also one other thing I would say. So the tense thing does not bother me at all as a reader. This is not a thing that worries me ever. But I will say that on this one, I did not remember this tense experience from the original read, and on this read I didn't notice it until this moment, which is
interesting.
Real bonkers, right? Because for me not to notice something like this on a what I'm trying to do as a close read, it feels like it, in that moment when I got to that line on page 86 and I sort of stopped and thought, wait, what does that line mean? And then I realized what she'd done, and I just sort of sat and stared into space for a little while and felt bad about myself.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I listened to this one. I'd read it the first time, and then I listened to it on audio.
Oh, yeah. How's that?
Oh, it's great.
But how's this moment?
Well, I was not as surprised, because when he's narrating Conrad and you hear when someone's speaking and the verb tense changes, I think you hear it differently. Mm. So I was really tuned into like, oh, Conrad sort of stuck in the present. And then like that moment when he switches over, it's very like weighty, right? Like it's like those ellipses, he really like drags them out.
Well, that's Petkoff for you. He's just good at his job.
Of course he is. So, I mean, I think the writing of this one, I think it's really spectacular. But I also think this is really a book where, I don't know if you remember when we read like the No Rest for the Wicked, we talked about like, okay, this is a book that's really setting up the players, but not necessarily the plot. I think this book is the opposite, right? Like, this is a book that's laying a lot of groundwork mm-hmm. for the future books, for the plot of The Accession. And in some ways, I do think it could be a bit of a distraction. Like, there are entire chapters that are away from Conrad and Naomi, which I don't think that happened in previous books.
No, it didn't. And I noticed it too. And I think you're 100% right. I actually had a moment, this is purely like writing as career moment in my head, where I was like, I wonder if she got like a big contract for this book. Like, I wonder if it was like, this is the first of 5 books, or like, you know, Pocket had signed on for lots more of them, because I feel like suddenly we're starting to see real groundwork laid for way in the future. And
I wondered that same thing, honestly.
Yeah. And I mean, who knows, maybe. And but the what's interesting about it is the secondary characters are all very richly included. So Bowen and Mariketta are right there at the very start. Mariketta is essential to the arc of the plot here.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really interesting because I started to think that perhaps what we were seeing was, and I don't know because I'm trying not to read too far ahead of the podcast, but I think what we may start to see is now she's layered enough immensely powerful characters into these stories that they're going to have to come back in order to solve some of these immense conflicts. So Mariketta and Bowen are back. The Caden Rydstrom crown conflict, which we start to see in separate chapters over the course of this book, I agree with you. It starts to feel almost too much, but then she so seamlessly knits it back to Conrad's conflict because he's being chased by a dream demon.
Yes.
Right? And there's all this kind of back and forth thing about he's drunk the blood of somebody who has information that Rydstrom needs for future book.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I mean, it's just there's so many little pieces. Like, this is where the murder wall really started to happen for me.
Yeah. Although, you know what I will say? Here's thematically, I think the way it worked is there's this one great scene where Nyx essentially gets Cadian and Rydstrom. And it's sort of like, what do you two jokers want? Do you want your crown or do you want your fated mates? And these two dubbies are like, my crown. And meanwhile, like, right on the other hand, you have Conrad, who's like, I just want Naomi and I don't care about anything else. Right. And I think in that sense, I think that's like kind of a powerful moment where you get Nyx literally like, I've never
actually.
She lays
it out for her.
Yes. Them. And I've never also had a book like actually like roll its eyes at me. And you could totally see her being like, you chuckleheads, like you are doing this wrong.
Well, you also start to see, I mean, Nyx is really beautiful in this book. She's been around, obviously, for the last few books, and she will be around for many, many more. But, like, this book, I feel like we're starting to see Nyx in, like, her fully formed, like, Valkyrie awesomeness. Regan, too, is with her for several scenes. And she's, you know, at one point she says she wants to lick Rydstrom's horns. And, like, ultimately we will discover that, like, demons and their horns are, like, a whole thing. And she's just so – and she's always wearing, like – funny t-shirts, and she just everything about her is so like brash and awesome. And at the same time, this is the book where we start to really see that Nyx is going to be the pin that holds it all together.
Absolutely.
And interestingly, I had a moment, there's no Lothair, there are no mentions of the other vampires.
This is very insular and sort of isolating, right? Like, just, you know, there, and part of that is because Naomi and Conrad are really stuck together in this house, literally.
Well, Naomi can't leave, right? So,
and he can't either because he has some witched he has some witched handcuffs on. So many handcuffs in this book. And also, well, we're gonna get to like book four for somebody losing their goddamn limbs.
He dislocates his shoulder, right? To get himself out of the...
He cuts off his own hand, Sarah.
Oh, God, he does. I forgot all about that. He does. He chops off his... He not just cuts it off, he chops it off with, like, an axe.
Yes, because he is like... Wait, it's my favorite moment in the book because, okay, it's like he looks down, right? And he just thinks, obstacle. Like, this is an obstacle. I need to get out of these chains so I can get my woman and we can get going out of here or whatever. And he, like, cuts off his own hand, not realizing that she has the key and has been hiding it from him. It's really an amazing moment.
It's magnificent. And then he's really an asshole because he's like, how dare you? You made me cut off my hand. Like, no, you're an idiot is what happened. The scenario that you have just painted is fully wrong. No one asked you to axe your hand off.
I know. Like the drama of that moment.
And interestingly, that's kind of that's the moment, right? Where Naomi's like, fuck you, I'm out.
Yeah, and I loved, and so it's funny because we've talked about a lot of this, but this is, I think, the part where she comes into her own, right? And there's this thing where she basically said, like, I never thought I'd be the type of woman to choose harsh words over, because I couldn't stand being alone. And she's basically like, bye, vampire, and she just like floats away to her secret hiding place because she's like, I'm not putting up with your bullshit.
And then she does literally, and in her secret hiding place, she summons Marichetta, who gets her the hell out.
Yes.
That's the moment where Marichetta, she brings Marichetta through the mirror, and then they have a conversation, and she's like, I want to be human. I want to be human. And Marichetta, and this, here's another reason why I love Naomi. This is the moment where, Marichetta, again, just as Nick said to the demons, like, what do you want? Marichetta said, I can do this for you, right? I can make you human, but I can only embody you for a certain length of time. It could be a day, it could be a year, but that's it. Like, it won't be longer than that. I can't tell you how long you have. All I can tell you is that if anybody ever finds out who or how we did this, you're done. Like, that's your last day.
And I love that Naomi's basically like, worth it, right? Like, I've been living in this, it's not even a half life.
Exactly.
Like, it's this nothingness. I want this last chance to be human and then to like really die. Like, that's worth it to her. And I think it's, again, this really fascinating look at, like, we've talked so much about immortality, but here's someone facing mortality. And she is like, really knows what she's doing, and she makes this decision. And I think it's a really spectacular moment, both because we understand, like, in some ways, like, we got that she was lonely, but this is when you're like, oh shit, you were lonely.
Yeah, because they basically say to her, and we don't know what happens to you. Like, there's no, we're not sure, like, where you go or what becomes of you. All we know is that you'll no longer be here and you'll never be here again.
Yeah, and I think in some ways this is why, you know, I understand that she's not like a Valkyrie type of heroine, but to me, so far, this has been one of the greatest moments of bravery in the entire series.
Of course, because it's such a moment of agency, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So the Valkyries are amazing on so many levels for so many reasons, right? Largely, probably reason one for me is their deep loyalty to each other. Naomi doesn't have a deep loyalty to each other to fall back on. Her loyalty has to be to herself, and she sees a chance to seize identity for one night or one week or one year, however long it is. And she takes it, and it's magnificent because it's pure agency. It for a character who on page one loses her all agency.
Right, exactly. And I love that it's another woman who helps her. Right? Like, there was something really powerful for me in this moment that, like Marichetta, that all the women in these books are so powerful, but like that when they need help and support, it's like they turn to other women. And I don't know, like, I just think like it was amazing. It blew me away.
While we are on the subject of Marichetta, I want to just draw attention to the climactic bits of this book, which I actually thought were the climactic bits of the last book.
Oh, like, interesting.
So I had this moment while I was reading
Winter.
Wicked Deeds on a Winter's Night, where I got to the end and there's the climactic scene where Marichetta is trapped in the mirror and they say to Bowen, don't stand in front of her because she'll incinerate you. And I thought to myself, like, oh, well, that's obviously what happened. When I was recollecting that book, I was convinced that that was the climactic scene, that he stands in front of her and she burns a hole in him. In fact, it happens here. It's like B plot,
right?
Here.
Yes. Right.
And this is why I was like, this Cressley has a plan for this series that is immense and remarkable. And I just want like the HBO miniseries. I want the HBO show, the like 6 seasons of this show, because
yes,
when Bowen stands in front of Marichetta in that moment and he says something like, you know, this is going to hurt like hell or something. It's this magnificent moment where you are reminded. It's that pure romance novel pleasure, right? Where you're reminded of how much you were rewarded in the last book by the love between those two people.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do this all the time as a writer. I like, you know, send a couple dancing by in the background for readers who, you know, maybe miss them. And I do it intentionally because I love the moment as a reader, but I also know that my readers are looking for it. And I didn't realize how much I was looking for it in this book until that moment where he does it. And then later, they come in and he's bleeding. Like, he has like holes in him, he's bleeding. And then he says, like, you're done with mirrors for
ever. Right. Right, exactly. Well, and I think, I mean, I loved that. I loved it so much. I mean, I think the other thing, like, I would love for us to talk about the fact that Conrad was a virgin.
Yes, that's on my list too, especially because Naomi is not. Again, we have a heroine. Cressley delivers us a heroine who is like super into sex, like likes it. Thank you.
And flat out was like, if I'd give anything for modern birth control, I would have done way more damage back in the 20s. And I was like, girl, I like love that moment.
Cressley's dealings with birth control over the course of all of her books, not just IED, but also Game Makers, are really, I think she does it really incredibly well, really thoughtfully, and also just like super badass. Like, birth control exists. We should all be on it. Like,
yes,
you should get to have sex, and that's that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I made a joke once on Twitter about how like there's like a subset of romance readers who really love a virgin hero, and it's like not really my cat, it's not my kink at all, like I don't care, it's fine, but I joke about, like, you know, some of you all love breaking in the ponies. And that was and I was like,
oh boy.
And meanwhile, if it was like the opposite and someone made that joke about like breaking in a woman, I'd be like, come over here so I can light you on fire. But it's really interesting that Conrad views his state as being something like shameful to be embarrassed by, right? And I think that's also just like a really interesting moment where, like, virginity, when it's in women, it's prized, right? Like, it's like, of course you're in the state of purity, but like how jacked up it is. And I think Cressley's like showing us that, right? Like, it's like this little hand she reveals, that for a man to be a virgin though is like this like shameful, embarrassing thing. Like, it's all a construct, and it's a construct on both ends. Mm-hmm. And of course, once they actually start having sex, he's like,
wash that out, baby. Make it hot,
baby. He's like fucking amazing, great at it, of course, right? Of course, like, just like, you know.
And for no reason. So, I mean, we are going to do a whole episode on The Player, which is my favorite of the Game Maker series, and I have a lot to say about that book. But I will say, like, the hero of that book spends like a full year studying sex to be great at it.
Hilarious.
Conrad's just awesome at it.
He's just awesome at it because he is. You know what I loved is, like, remember when you were talking about Lachlan learning to drive?
He's preternaturally strong. And
and that's what I was thinking about, like, Conrad and the fucking. He's just preternaturally talented at this activity. Just, bless.
This is his secret.
It's like
skill.
It's like if you grow up in Montana and you just like discover you have this affinity for fly fishing, right? Like, he's just so gifted at this. Lucky girl, Naomi.
Which is great. It's just great. But actually, great. My favorite moment of virginity in this book is at the very, when they first reveal it. And there's a back and forth, and it's his brother. And Conrad is just, let me paint a picture. Conrad is strapped to a bed because he can't, like, anytime they chain him to anything else, he pulls it out of the wall. So he's strapped to the bed, and he can see Naomi there, but he's pretending not to see her because he's not 100% certain he's not crazy.
Right.
And she's just standing there watching them because she doesn't think he can see her. And there's a back and forth, and Nikolai says, but aren't you? And Conrad's like, don't say it. Don't say it. Don't say it. But he can't, like, articulate. He can't say, like, because there's a lady here watching us. And Nikolai's right. like, but aren't you a virgin? And Naomi's like, dead.
I know. And she's like, right on. I'm going to take care of this for you. We'll figure it out. Yeah, I mean, so I don't know. I thought that was, like, also really interesting because Sebastian, of course, was, like only had been with a few women, right?
Yeah, but because of war.
Right.
I mean, that's an okay reason.
Right. I mean, and so it was like, a really interesting way that this, like, gets turned on its head, too, right? Like, she's the one who's sexually experienced, and he is the one who's a virgin, and...
And she's so chill about it, too. She's like, oh, you're a virgin? Okay. Like, well, what would you do with me? Let me get my clothes off. Tell me. Let me get in the shower with you. Tell me what you would do with me.
Yeah. It's super sexy.
It's pretty great. And then the moment, I mean, we also, this is the second time we've seen a vampire blooded.
Yes.
And I do love a blooding.
Me too.
Like, I don't know. I think I'm going to say it, and it might be controversial, listeners, but I think I prefer a blooding to a werewolf moon mating.
I am going to agree with that.
All right.
I think I'm down with that.
If you have opinions about this, tell us on Twitter.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that here's the part that's also kind of interesting, like, back to, like, this whole business with the virgin, and there's a couple really funny moments where he's like, well, how many men have you been with? They're playing essentially a game of, like, truth or dare, right? And she's like, 4. And he's like, that many? And then, like, she asks him how many people he's killed, and he basically is like, thousands or hundreds or whatever.
I can't remember.
And she's like, wait, and you're judging me for, like, getting with these 4 guys?
Pretty glorious, right?
It is really glorious.
Well, there's also a moment where he says, are you a virgin? And she says, no, I'm a Capricorn.
Oh, and he probably is like, what? Yeah.
I love it.
And I think the other thing that was, like, a really funny moment for me where at one point both of them make the observation, like, she's like, why are men so angry when they're vulnerable? And, and he thinks, like, why are women, when they're vulnerable, they just come out with their, like, claws, essentially. And it's, like, this moment where you realize, like, and I want to say it's, like, human. I mean, he's a vampire, right? But, like feeling angry and defensive when you're vulnerable isn't about gender, right? It's about being human. And I think that's part of what's really interesting too, is like you said, like, he's discovering, he's getting back in touch with his humanity.
Sure. And there's this magnificent moment right at the end, so right in the climactic bits of the book, where they bring her back as a phantom and they put her in a zombie body. And there's that whole discussion that she might come back wrong. For the Pet Sematary fans in the crowd. And so he goes to the middle of a war zone to, like, find his brothers and, like, get them out of a witched cage. This is the only time that we see the other vampires, because Christoph is there and Christoph lets them go, right? So he goes to get his brothers, and he says, I've been blooded. I've met the woman I love. I need you to take me to every single cemetery in New Orleans right now, because she's trapped. Like, I need to save her.
Yeah.
So essentially, Nikolai has been to every cemetery in New Orleans. And they don't believe him. They don't believe Conrad. They think he's crazy. And Nikolai says, all right, I'll do this for you. And he does it. And Conrad says, why would you do this? You don't believe me. And he says, because you came to me. And that means somewhere in you, I'm still your brother. And
I know.
It's such a powerful moment because essentially it's Conrad getting his humanity back, not just via love, but also via family.
Right.
And we've talked about this before with Cressley and found family and real family, but it's a really powerful moment and it's what Conrad deserves. I think that's the thing I don't understand about people who don't love this book. I feel like this is the first one where I feel like these two people deserve happiness.
Yeah.
In a really profound way.
And also the one where I really was like, even rereading, I was like, how's this going to work out again? She's a ghost.
Well, there is a lot of like, now we need a witch. Now we need a sorceress.
Yes, exactly. And you know what?
Now you're a phantom. Don't ask us why. That's not a critique of Cressley, really. That's like a Nick's. It's that sort of perfection of putting. So if you're a comedy, if you've ever studied comedy writing, there's this concept in comedy, right, in like half hour sitcom comedy writing, that if you create a character who is a dog, like you can basically have them do anything. And that doesn't mean like an actual dog. Dog is a metaphor. So it's like Homer Simpson can do basically anything. And we believe it because he acts like a dog, right? He's pure id. Kramer is a dog. Joey Tribbiani is a dog. Right?
Yeah.
Like in this particular moment, right? Nyx is a dog in the sense that, like,
right.
She's just been set up to know whatever she knows and act however she acts. And so when she's like, you know, maybe you'll be a phantom, maybe.
Right.
We're like, oh, well, Nyx would know.
Sure. Sure. Well, and again, I think it's like at some point, it's both like brilliant and also like sort of. I don't know, like world building wise, I wonder how people. So I don't care about world building at all. I actually, one of the reasons I prefer paranormal to fantasy is I have a pretty low tolerance for world building. I get really overwhelmed by like the details.
Yeah, same.
And so I'm really happy to have like, oh, thank God there's this like magical character who just needs to know who knows everything she needs to know. Mm-hmm. And oh, thank God there's Mariketta. She can just like fucking spell up anything she needs to spell. And I like that a lot. But I wonder if people who really love fantasy find that to be like an unbearable shortcut.
Probably, but I don't care.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, that might be because I like that's why I like paranormal better than fantasy.
Sure. I just want them to get together and smooch. That's what I want. So like just make it work. I don't care. And there it is. Sarah McLean on romance novels.
Well, you've heard me say this is why I find like television shows almost unbearable to watch. I'm like, you want me to sit down and watch 13 episodes of this freaking show and I'm going to get like them kissing once 45 minutes through episode 13.
I know. Like, and they're like, no, it's such a slow burn. Shut up.
I'm like, I would like a faster burn.
A slow burn has to be resolved in 360 pages or less.
That's right. In one day's reading, I could get I could get a lot more than a kiss, y'all. But it is, and I find that to be, I think that's part of why I like reading books, like, right? Like, I know I'm going to get that whole arc.
Okay, so here is the one thing that I know we're not getting to it until a million episodes from now, but I have to talk about Sweet Ruin every single podcast.
Of course you do. It's fine.
Because I love it so much. But there is a moment in this where Nyx says, brings up phantoms and says, but it takes hundreds and or even thousands of years for a phantom to happen.
Yeah.
And it's such a throwaway line. And I was like, oh my God. If I had been paying close, if I had done a full reread before Sweet Ruin.
I would have seen that.
So, I mean, it's these little moments where you just start to see like, the layering of these books is really remarkable.
I agree. There was, can I just say, there was like one other thing though that I thought was really interesting, which is along with the building for like what's coming in future books, there are some references back to things that happened in previous books. So if you remember at the end of No Rest for the Wicked, Riora gives Sebastian sort of a, like, right, a second chance to use the, whatever, the time turner thing, whatever it's really called. Like, right, that they can go back to the past and change things.
The key.
The key, thank you. And I was like, the time turner. Hello, Hermione. Thank
you. That's fine. We love a Hermione thing. Reference.
Who doesn't? But it's really interesting that in this one, Conrad hears them talking, like, and it's like, maybe we're going to have to use Riora's gift, but it's the brothers who are talking. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, this, and Sebastian is so fully back in the fold with his brothers that he essentially discloses to them that he has, you know, this mystical item, and they decide together, presumably, not to go back and save their sisters, right? But to hold on to it for potential future use. And I had not remembered that that sort of like came back up again.
Well, you know, that's one of those moments where as a writer, I noticed that too. And as a writer, I was like, oh, that's just smart. Because you never know when you might have to get out of a hole. And a time turner.
Is a big
real useful.
Oh yeah, for sure. Right,
and maybe Cressley has like, she probably does because she's so good at this, she probably has some like grand plan for that time turner, but I for sure would just put that on the, that's one gun that I would leave on the table.
Oh, for sure. Right,
for as long as it needed to be left.
Yeah, but I like that she like mentioned again, right? Like, yeah, it's still there, and a couple people know about it, and you know, I haven't forgotten about this super powerful mystical item that's just like hanging out waiting to be used.
Right. So I would say that this is the first of the books where I would say you could read this book on its own, but this is probably the last. You could start the series here is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
but
I think so.
This is probably the last book where you can start.
Yeah.
Without it starting to get real complicated.
Yeah, I would agree.
And that's because, as we said, she uses this experience, she uses this book to really set up the next four or five.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And to that end, we should talk about what the next one is.
We should.
2 weeks from now, Dark Desires After Dusk, book five. And it is Caden Woad, our first demon.
So can I give you a Robert Peckhoff pronunciation guide
here? Oh, yeah. Oh, please.
He's saying Woad.
Oh, really?
I know. And I was like, okay, it sounds like they're like...
Well, I mean, I think Cressley and Robert are friends. I mean, they have to
be at
this point, right?
I'm sure they like talked about it, right?
Woad.
And I thought it was really interesting because that in my brain, I had also been saying like Woad. So,
Woad.
Yeah, the Woad.
I wonder, at some point in the middle of the night, I'm going to wake up and be like, I wonder if she means this.
Yeah, no, totally.
I wonder what that pronunciation means. Okay, so it's Caden Woad, our first demon. He's a rage demon, which is fun. I also love the demons because they're more fun than everyone else.
Oh, absolutely.
The demons.
Yeah.
All the demons in this series are super fun. Oh, speaking of, I want to talk about somebody on Twitter, you guys. And Faded Mates Twitter account reposted this, and we'll put it in show notes. But somebody on Twitter brought it to my attention that you can get specialized ringtones with Robert Peckhoff doing the like most fun IAD characters, including DeShazer, who is like a rando demon who doesn't even have his own book, but is super delightful.
He is super delightful. Yeah.
And who I have like a whole, like basically if I were the kind of person who had the time to write fan fiction in the IAD universe, I would totally write about DeShazer, who's got to come fairly soon, I would think, if he's that famous.
Yeah. I think he shows up quite a bit in like Sweet Ruin and like maybe he's just like, in the ending book, so he's more recent in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only options are Roon, Luthair, and Deshazer. I don't think any of the other heroes have ringtones, so it came later in the game, but yeah, they're awesome, and we'll put links in the show notes for you. I've already set Jen's ringtone on my phone to that, but Jen doesn't call me very often, so that's a bummer. You should call me more.
Now I'm like, obviously, the minute we stop recording, I'm going to be like, ring, except it's going to be like Roon being like, hello, Dove.
That is exactly what it is. It's Roon saying,
answer my call. It's Roon.
Anyway, but that all said, we're meeting the demons. The demons are super fun because they like have, first of all, they're not like worried about their mates really, because they can have sex as much as they want. Basically, the way a demon finds their mate is they just like keep trying them.
Yeah.
Which is kind of awesome.
It is an attempt.
It's called an attempt. It's pretty delightful. And Holly Ashwin, who is human for all intensive purposes.
Right. As far as we know.
Mm-hmm. And that's delightful. And what we know, if you've been reading along, the last, one of the final chapters of this book is Caden outside Holly's house watching her, knowing that she's his mate, but choosing not to go to her.
Right. Well, and remember, right, like we've get that. That's like one really important scene, right, is they've made this decision to prioritize getting back Rydstrom's crown. And, you know, they get some hardcore side eye from Nyx. But the other thing is, as Cadian has, he thinks he's killed Naomi, right? Remember?
Oh, right.
And so there's this scene where he, and what Nyx tells Rydstrom is, like, if you tell him that he has to go forward thinking that he's done this, this like decision tree, all like this is where it splits, and you have to tell him that she doesn't survive. And so the way that like sort of Naomi's story kind of gets like kind of carried forward into the lore is she's officially part of the lore now that she's a phantom, but like this moment where her body is killed, which was going to happen all along, right? Like it was inevitable once the spell was cast. Cadian is the one who carries that guilt forward. And even though everybody else knows that she lives or like, right, has been brought back, he doesn't. And I, like you, have been trying not to read ahead because I don't want to like sort of spike the ball inadvertently, right? And so I'm really curious to see, like, why it has to play out that way. But that's also the sense of these books being, like, really tightly interwoven now, like, with each other.
Yeah. This is why I think if you are going to start with us and you haven't started yet, now is the time. Also, why are you listening to this podcast if you haven't read these books?
It's the dulcet tones of our voices in their ear holes, Sarah.
It is. Well, we're done with your ear holes today.
We are.
I'm Sarah McLean, and you can find me at Sarah McLean everywhere.
Yeah, and I'm Jen Prokop. You can find me on Twitter at Jen Reads Romance. On Instagram at Jen Reads Romance CHI, because the other Jen Reads Romance on Instagram is Jennifer Porter on Twitter. It's all very confusing. And my website, jenreadsromance.com.
And you can find Faded Mates at Faded Mates on Twitter, at Faded Mates Pod on Instagram. Send us, tag us on Instagram if you take pictures, if you're reading along. We want to see what you're reading. We want to see your, like, if you're highlighting or marking. We love marginalia here at Faded Mates.
Oh, we do.
So take pictures and we will repost them on our Instagram account with giving you all due credit. If you are really enjoying, don't forget to subscribe using your favorite podcasting platform, whatever it may be. We like Overcast over here, but whatever. We take all kinds. Don't forget to like us, review us. And also if there's anything that comes up as you're reading and you want us to talk about it, let us know. And maybe we'll find an expert to come and talk about it.
Have a great night, everybody, and we'll see you next time on Faded Mates. So, I am going to say this one thing. We are actually going to be interviewing an expert on moon science because I have many complaints and many questions about how the moon is portrayed in these books.
I have absolutely no complaints.
I know you don't. Complaints is maybe a strong word. Complaints makes me sound insane. And it's not complaints, right? I have questions and I have observations. And our friend Jamie Green actually hooked us up with someone who is like an expert on moon science. And we're going to do like a real quick interview with her. And I'm going to ask her all my questions. And we're all just going to be learning together to be better observers of the moon.
But I think we're probably going to save that one for the next werewolf book.
Yeah.
So we will try to hold it together until then with our excitement about moon science. But we're excited.